Hey, Bobby Manning, episode 48 of Dome Theory is here. Want to give you an update first on what we're going to be doing here in the weeks to come on this show. We have a line of interviews coming up. Every Monday is what I'm going to be hitting on, aiming to get those out in live stream format so you can see them direct, raw, to the point, and have great conversations live with your questions on the air so you can see what's going on with our conversations with some great people who went from aspiring to do something to doing it, which is what we talk about here on the show. But there's also a lot of other stuff we want to talk about as well. Today, of course, everybody's mind on the Derek Chauvin verdict out of Minnesota. We'll get to that in 1 second. But first, Monday, interview day, we will be doing music culture discussions on Friday, and those collectively will come out on Monday. So you'll get the Friday weekend edition. It might go to Saturday, depending on when game nights are. And then you'll have our interview for Monday packed in the one podcast. So you can listen to one thing throughout the week that's timely. I think that's going to be the best schedule to do this, as well as the best way to fit it into our streaming schedule in CLNS Media. So make sure you subscribe to Dome Theory on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcast, we're there, and you'll listen to all of our streams, all of our discussions, as well as some bonus interview content occasionally that we're going to be throwing into that podcast stream if you're subscribing to it. So keep an eye on that. What I'm trying to do is keep it to one episode every week. Might be multiple interviews, it might be multiple takes, might be multiple things packed within, probably end up being an hour or just above that. But you're going to be able to skip through it, get what you want, and just have it all in one place so you're not getting bombarded with podcast episodes throughout the week or missing them or having them end up in spots where you're probably not going to listen and then have some other podcasts jump in front of that one. So that's our plan. We're releasing this one midweek, so we're already off to a great start, but I do have to hit on the Derek Chauvin verdict, which was released after the interview that we did here today with Noah Eagle. Jarring moment. It was shocking to a lot of people, I believe, to see an officer not only convicted of murder, but to have that visual. And, you know, in these cases, you don't always have a camera in there, but in this COVID environment and given the scale and interest in the case, the judge there, Peter Cahill, decided to have cameras in the courtroom throughout this one. So that made a compelling trial to follow. And I ended up being that I'm working here at home in the Casa, watched just about every minute of this trial. And some things stood out to me. I know a lot of people are taking this in from that final visual, and the visual was powerful of Chauvin getting all three guilty verdicts thrown at him and then getting slapped in cuffs. There were two, I think, or there was three great lines in this trial. The former MMA fighter, witness, and person who was yelling at Chauvin on the scene that day, saying that he had to call the police on the police. He said that line a couple times. That is a certainly poetic moment from this case, as well as the prosecutor Blackwell, Ryan Blackwell, I think was his name, saying that George Floyd didn't die because his heart was too big. Floyd died because Derek Chauvin's heart was too small. But there was still that seed of doubt within the American public that a police officer, even in a case with his video, even in a case where the killing was brutal in a way that resonated around the world to people who might not even sympathize with this issue or believe it to be an issue. So that drew this out to a scale where the entire world was able to protest. And due to the COVID pandemic, many people weren't bound to work. There was mass unemployment numbers. There was a free time and a lack of distraction in the world at that point that allowed it to become a moment where we could have grasped and pushed for bigger systematic change in this place. And that's what stuck with me as I watched this trial. So there was a couple of takeaways I had after Chauvin got convicted And I'm going to share them with you. But this moment here, if you're watching the video version, and we'll play it, of him getting the cuffs slapped on him, a police officer going to jail for police misconduct for murdering a black man. The first time in Minneapolis history that this happened was understandably a big emotional and jarring visual for the American public to see. You don't see this, you don't expect this. And even in this case, where it seemed like the evidence was so stacked against him, and as someone who did watch most of this case, it was hard to believe that this wasn't going to be a guilty verdict, given the amount of witnesses, police officers, as well as medical professionals who weighed in and said this was undoubtedly a murder. So this is the lasting visual out of this trial that people are going to remember for some time as one of the most anticipated trials maybe since OJ in this country. And this is what we saw.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Third degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. Second degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
So there you had it. That was the verdict. There were celebrations in the street. There was victory announced, and everybody had a weigh in. Everybody had to say their piece on this. The Boston Celtics weighed in, of course. The NBA, the sports world was able to say how this made them feel and what the significance of this verdict was, as well as politicians. Joe Biden went live and gave a grand speech about policing in America and what this means for it, as well as in another headline, Nancy Pelosi, as well as the former girlfriend of George Floyd, coming out and saying that George Floyd, they thank George Floyd for sacrificing his life for justice. Which we're going to get into a number of reactions to this verdict and problems I have with them. But this one, particularly from Pelosi, now, Floyd's girlfriend's one thing. I get the sense of what she's saying better than what Pelosi's saying. Floyd's girlfriend said this in a way that meant he became significant. He became someone that others empathize with and put pressure on people in power to do something about. And that is going to be his legacy. And that's what he died for. Even though that quote in particular says that Floyd had a decision in this and he just let himself go. When in that moment we saw, for those who watched that video, him pleading for life, him asking for help, him not receiving it. And that ultimately being the miscarriage of power and authority in this circumstance, it just kind of miscasts what happens there. But for Pelosi to say it, when she is sitting in a position of power to be able to change these things, say something and do something significant about it as the Speaker of the House, and for a verdict that's outside her hands and ultimately won't set precedents in these circumstances, we needed to see the most extreme example of police brutality, police killing, with multiple videos from various angles and an array of witnesses to maybe get a guilty verdict in this case. Nobody in the country thought that this was a slam dunk. And you throughout this trial saw the built-in legal code of the United States of America and the various states where this stuff goes on being used by the defense to cast arguments that improbably could have kept Chauvin out of jail. We think of the use of drugs and addiction on George Floyd's part being used as an excuse to rip life from him and dehumanize him and push the ultimate use of force in the circumstance. That argument was made by the defense. We saw his size, uncertainty, all these words were used about this moment where he was being in handcuffs, put in the car, used to justify the killing in this case. There was no doubt little doubt throughout this that the cause of death for Floyd was the knee to the neck, the lack of oxygen, that kind of stuff. But you had an array of justifications being thrown out there that could have stood. You know, you can go back on Reddit. You can go throughout the internet for people's handbook law assessment on why it was unlikely you were going to be able to get Chauvin convicted with murder here. And who knows? There's still appeals processes here. There's still quite a few arguments that can be made that possibly could throw this case out. So that is the first reason to pause over this. If it stands, Pelosi is 100% wrong. The significance of the George Floyd trial is that it was a shock for in this system, the way the U.S. and its culture assess police versus black people, for a jury of Floyd's peers to indict a police officer for what under the law could have been justified is what's wrong here. There is a massive amount of leeway for police to kill people in this country. There is a significant isolation of policing on black communities and minority communities. So those are two of the built-in reasons for these cases coming up in the first place. And then on top of that, there are a number of legal standards like qualified immunity and other things that could be aggressively pushed to be put out of the law books in this country, but haven't been because of the influence of police unions on politics, the fearfulness of politicians and trying to indicate that this was a characterization of policing in America. You heard this quote throughout this, that this isn't policing. Police don't even agree with this. This is different than anything we've ever seen before. That's what the likes of Trump and others were, who typically weren't going to stand up in these situations and criticize a police officer. But progress like cameras, dash cameras, those kind of initiatives that police often push back so hard against, made this one indisputable in a way that maybe others weren't. And in the time since, we've seen Dante Wright die. We've seen Breonna Taylor fail to get justice in her name, despite the apparent misconduct in those cases as well, and Taylor in particular. No camera, no film. So the police are given the benefit of the doubt in those situations. And legally in this country, en masse, police are still given the benefit of the doubt in the moment, in the courtroom, and then beyond that. Misconduct often leads to release of duties in one location and then the ability to move on to duty in a different location, as we saw in that Florida case at the time. Sometimes accountability in their circumstances is a retirement, a reassignment of duty. Countless police in this country who have killed black people in controversial ways have been put back on the job. Rayshard Brooks's killer in Atlanta is an example you can look back on from that whole George Floyd protest summer. So these are the kind of things that you come out of this. And it's fantastic that George Floyd got justice, which is what was done here. Justice under this legal system was a surprise and shocked many. But it's not changing that legal system. Now, Floyd did move the needle in some kind of way that is certainly historic, but that change has been slow. It has seen 1,000 people per year die in this country in the hands of police. And so Floyd's justice isn't bringing him back. It will hopefully make his family feel better, his loved ones, as well as the community of Minneapolis that I think has worked hard on this issue. They moved to defund the police and move assets into other locations. We saw in the Brooklyn Center killing of Dante Wright last week, the chief let go. the city manager let go, and the mayor, who is black, be a vocal advocate of what protesters and people in the streets there wanted last summer. And that is something I take out of this as well. The significance of rioting, protesting, whatever you want to call it. My friend Anthony Doyle here on Twitter says this doesn't happen without riots. Yes, riots, not protests last summer. Don't let anyone fucking tell you that rioting won't work. Disrupting the system is how you get its attention. And we can parse words over what this entails. But ultimately, the pressure of unrest in the streets, stepping on doorsteps of elected officials, being in these meetings and confronting these elected officials, anything that was done to confront power last summer certainly had an impact here. And so that is one of the lasting lessons out of this one that is valid. America, the media, politicians can say, go to the sidewalk at this time and then go home at 7 o'clock and everything will be all good. But who is power in this country to define what protests look like? That has always sat unwell with me, and it's ugly. Sometimes property is destroyed. Occasionally, small businesses suffer massive damage and have to shut down, and those are tragic circumstances. But that's small in the whole scale of moral wrongdoing in this country compared to the justification of allowing the state to kill people just by casting criminality on people. And that's the other side to this as well. What else did we hear in this trial? Floyd did drugs. Floyd used a fraud $20 bill that allowed the police in the first place to encroach upon him and find all these other issues that he's gone through in his life. And then each of those issues were magnified and attempted to be used as justification for killing him. And that's what we see with the legal system in the U.S. It's so vast. It's so built on being able to access people's private lives, confront them in traffic stops, which we saw go tragically here. Now, I don't pretend to have the answer to any of this stuff, but I do know that we have to reassess it and think about the system rather than the individual cases. Why does the system in the U.S. allow 1,000 people to be killed by police when that doesn't happen anywhere else in the developed world? Why is it so difficult to convict and take police officers out of the line of duty when wrongdoing is committed? And I think people across this country right now can agree that the police in many circumstances are misusing their power, but the legal system at large doesn't have the power to strip them of their power. And why is that? That has to change. And George Floyd dying to send one police officer to prison, it isn't the final answer to that problem. In fact, it doesn't even address the problem. It just allows us to feel good about ourselves. And I think that's a big problem with America right now. I'm not going to take away the good feeling and the accomplishment and the work that was done by people to achieve this guilty verdict. That is certainly progress. But what level of progress is it in the grand scheme of things? And where does it go from here? That's what has to be answered. How much better are we going to feel about America if George Floyd's continues to happen across the country in years to come because there wasn't enough change affected out of this circumstance? This has to be used as a moment to capitalize. And certainly, I think many cities and municipalities across the country did within the last year. But it can't be a moment of resting, complacency. And so what bothers me most out of this week is the report from Axios about this administration that I think has been complacent at times on a number of issues due to its popularity and due to its ability to put money in people's pockets early on in the administration. And frankly, this campaign slogan and mission statement from the president that I'm not Trump. So that's all that matters. So the report from Axios yesterday is that Chauvin verdicts reduce pressure for police reform. The unanimous guilty verdicts against Derek Chauvin are a huge relief for Washington's political establishment, but seem unlikely to rush in the systemic overhauls George Floyd's family and civil rights leaders and progressive leaders seek. An acquittal and mistrial involving the former police officer would have unleashed violence and days more of protest. This is what they're worried about in Washington and at the governmental level. How can we maintain peace, stability, and the status quo? Not what can get broader reforms done in a timely manner. What better time than now, when the Senate, the House, and the presidency are in Democratic hands? What better time than now? We're going to make something good come out of this tragedy. Again, this notion on America's part that one surprise verdict is going to bring down the driving train of white supremacy in this country. And the intersectionality of this issue is important to consider, because I don't want to make this podcast a driving condemnation of policing as a whole. Because guess what? There are a million guns in every state, and the prevalence of those guns is what has allowed the police army state to be built up and empowered and look like the U.S. Army rolling through streets at times. And that, in some part, is on account of the proliferation of guns throughout this country. And that is another devious tactic that has allowed the police state, the carceral state, to be built up in the country the way that it has, and to have mass numbers of gun violence take people on this country. And at this point in the past month, there have been numerous mass shootings. And what's being done to address that? Again, with the massive victory that this country handed the Democratic Party, that says to be in favor of all these things and be pushing to work on these matters. And so they're coming at it, this administration is coming at it reportedly through Axios, in a standpoint of, oh, we don't have to do this now because the demand isn't there, the pressure isn't there on us. This is just my take on this from seeing how power acts in this country. Just last week, different example, the Biden administration was heavily criticized for rolling back refugee intake in this country. And people saw that, they identified that, they blasted it out on a wider scale and made the administration change course on that. Same can be done here. Instead of looking at the George Floyd verdict and saying, victory, mission accomplished, we can look at a report like that from Axios and say, oh, so George Floyd's going to have a legacy here, but you reportedly are using this as a excuse to get out of doing difficult change, getting rid of qualified immunity, passing this George Floyd police bill, and perhaps being deemed by a different group in this country as police haters, or all the tropes that get thrown on anybody in favor of police reform in this country. That was a massive issue last summer, when any idea of change was just hit back with, oh, you're anti-police, Blue Lives Matter, this kind of stuff that is done to delegitimize the other side. And Democrats are scared of that. They are terrified. Them and Republicans lean heavily on police, money, votes, organizing. to maintain their positions at every level. And this is the difficult thing about this. You have state police at the state level. They are dictating a lot of times who's in office across the country on a state level. And then on a local level, certainly they are some of the biggest power players in local politics. And frankly, this is a local level issue. And so last summer to see organization being done at a local level was so important. And you did see some change done in certain municipalities across the country. But then you have to put that against crime rates and these other issues in the country that frankly need to be addressed in a timely manner as well. So when you get into the intersectionality of this issue, that's when it becomes clear how damaging and dangerous complacency in this moment is. This issue is linked to so many others that need such urgent addressing, as particularly in this moment where people are suffering from the pandemic and numbers are starting to go back up and people are dying from that. Again, all these issues are connected. And I loved Greg Popovich, to bring this back to sports as we jump into this episode here, being willing to make that connection in small part. How can we address this? How can we make change happen here? Follow the money. And in any given organization, you can follow the money, see where it goes, and see why things are the way they are. And Greg Popovich hammers that perfectly from an NBA decision. Why are sports talking about political issues in this country? Because sports owners, the power players in sports, shoe companies, anybody who makes that world turn, they have significant pull. So Greg Popovich, after Dante Wright died, talked for 5 minutes and targeted the reason all this stuff is going on in this country and where we need to look. And articles have been written about this in some part already, where NBA money goes and what kind of causes it supports, contrasted against the image of a progressive league that's doing everything it can to solve these issues. And some on the other side might even say too much is being done on that front. Well, if you look at the facts here, that might not actually be the truth.
It's childish, it's sickening, it's dangerous. And do these people want a country or not? Do these people have grandchildren? Do they want their grandchildren to go to work, to go to school, and go through these drills and worry about being murdered? What does it take to care more about them than your frickin' power and your position and your donors? And with policing, it's the same damn way. How many young black kids have to be killed for no frickin' reason? How many? So that we can empower the police unions. We need to find out who funds these people. I want to know what owners in the NBA fund these people who perpetrate these lies. Maybe that's a good place to start. So it's all transparent.
That's everything we're talking about right here. And did that change because George Floyd's killer was convicted? No. One of those organizations in question here are putting a PR front out so that they can have a paragraph of PR speak replace action and pointed ideas for how to change this thing. We're going to pass sentiment over policy. And what way did that ring truer yesterday than the LA or the Las Vegas Raiders tweeting this out? I can breathe. That is the mission accomplished banner of social justice PR. And they left it up. Now, there are a number of things wrong here. Beyond the fact that research wasn't done to see that police in the aftermath of the Eric Garner killing, I believe it was, c- Counter protesters in support of the NYPD wore shirts of the same slogan in an apparent reference to Eric Garner. So that's the first thing wrong here. They probably just needed a Google search to reveal. But beyond that, this isn't what happened here. George Floyd said, "I can't breathe," and died. What happened in court is literally the opposite of this. It did nothing to bring him back to life. And more George Floyds will happen because this is what you're doing with your money, resources, and audience. You're putting out a misguided tweet that convinces America, particularly white America, your fan base, your paying customers, that we're all good here. Everything's fine. Mission accomplished. In fact, I can breathe. George Floyd's back. That is not what happened here. And ultimately, let's be real. If you dig into the facts of this case, law in Minnesota, they talked about Bradley, the Bradley case, where sentencing is based on your past criminal history. And since police aren't convicted of crimes and law enforcement is isolated on black communities and putting people in a system, a carceral state, and having them rotated in and out of it, your sentencing is based on your past record. So it is the expectation that Chauvin will serve 12 to 15 years for crimes that carry as many as 40 in one instance. And how is that going to make people feel when that is announced in 8 weeks? Now, there are other ways the judge can go to push that upward, and the prosecutors are certainly doing that. But like I said from the very beginning here, the prosecutors in this case had to come at it from a standpoint of policing is good. It is a noble institution in this country. And this one guy stepped out of line there. This isn't a greater issue. This case isn't about a bigger issue at hand here. This is about one guy who you need to convict. And I understand the legal strategy behind that, but that in turn is another reason I look at the legal profession and say a lot of people go toward it to try to change these things, but instead end up having to adapt to a system that maintains these things. How are we going to have a case where the argument, in order to win, had to say this isn't a statement on policing at large in this country? So how is policing at large in this country going to change? One guy who was already fired by his department is going to jail for some amount of time while the rest of the world spins on and Dante Wright's, Breonna Taylor's, and others are continuing to be pulled out of it. There's a number of reasons why that will continue to happen that we can talk about at another time. But I just want people to think and critically analyze what happened this week. I'm not saying it's not a victory. I am saying it is not mission accomplished. And rest in peace to George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and Dante Wright. We're talking to Noah Eagle today on Dome Theory. He is going to fill us in on the LA Clippers, Rajon Rondo's effect. I believe the Clippers are 9-2 this month after the trade of Lou Williams for Rajon Rondo, which on paper looked like a risk at the time and a significant forfeiture of an asset on LA's part to acquire a player who had been struggling with the Atlanta Hawks this year. But he has saved the Clippers. Why is that? We're going to get into that with him. Who is the MVP? And why is the MVP harder than ever before to nail down? And why is it making people so angry? We'll talk about that as well today, along with why Jason Tatum is going to win an MVP in the next 6 years. I went to school with LA Clippers broadcaster, believe he's 24 years old, 23, 24 years old, one of the youngest broadcasters in the NBA. Noah Eagle, we're going to talk about where NBA broadcasting is going, where the league is at right now, as well as a difficult year for the league at large. And we will talk to you on Monday for episode 49 of Dome Theory. I'm Bobby Manning. Thanks for rolling with me through that tough intro. Tough one to get off the chest here and articulate, but I think that was what needed to be said in a moment like this. So Noah Eagle is next. And our sponsor here is Bet Online. BetOnline.ag, who I use on a regular basis for my odds, my props, futures. If I'm looking into what Vegas is thinking about the sports world at large, I'm using BetOnline. And if I have a gut feeling, a major inclination of what is going to happen in the future, I'm going to put some money on it on BetOnline. And what's great is through CLNS Media, we allow you to get 50% back on your first deposit. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Football is over, but NBA, college basketball, not anymore, and NHL are in full swing. BetOnline even covers awards, TV shows, and reality TV. That never ends. Real-time updated odds and props on almost anything you can imagine. You can even create some lines over on betonline.ag, I've seen, by using the website. They have you covered on news, scores, odds. It's the best way to place your bets, and it's free to sign up. Head over to the website and use your mobile device. The new website's great, by the way, and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action. Don't forget to use the promo code CLNS50 to receive a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Here's something I'd be looking at if I was heading over to BetOnline today. The Rookie of the Year odds. Minus 325 odds on LaMelo Ball. That means you can get Anthony Edwards plus 180, Tyrese Halliburton plus 750, and even Emmanuel Quickly plus 6,600. They consider LaMelo Ball a shoe-in. If you feel like Edwards, Halliburton have surpassed him in the time he's been out, or Ball might even miss more time coming forward, those are some really good odds there. Now, if you see Ball coming back and being a lock, those aren't terrible odds either. So go check that out. Other awards as well. MVP, which we're going to talk about today. Nikola Jokic, minus 350. Joel Embiid, plus 300. Steph Curry, who is making strides at a massive rate with his 11-game 30-point streak, plus 1,000. So those are some odds you're going to want to go over to BetOnline and check out. It's a turbulent year. Those voting races might carry some surprises this year, but there are some dominant frontrunners as well who you may be able to cash in on if you are fully confident Ball, Jokic, Julius Randle, and most improved are going to come away with that one. Here is our chat with Noah Eagle. And I know all the Celtics fans are going to be asking you about Rajon Rondo here live in the chat as he comes to LA and basically turns his team around. Haven't even gotten the playoff Rondo yet, and the experience is already starting to manifest itself. We're going to talk about that and a ton of stuff here with Noah Eagle, who is their radio play-by-play guy out there in LA, as well as, perfect for this show, a fellow Syracuse grad. He was there when I was there, probably like a year or two apart. I was in the press rooms before those games. And, you know, I knew who you were because of who your dad was. We weren't that yeah. I probably said hi to you or something back then, but you know, I've always wanted to interview you, get to know your experience, and there are a million different ways I could come at this. You've probably been interviewed 100 times throughout your career about you and your dad's relationship, but thanks to the news this week that Jimmy Boeheim is going to be transferring to Syracuse, I can come at this a different way and ask this Boeheim experience at Syracuse. Now, coming into this next season, it's going to be Jimmy Boeheim, Buddy Boeheim, as well as Jim Boeheim at the helm for year 45 or 46 now for him at Syracuse. And I've just found it so fascinating. Obviously, I think you covered Buddy Boeheim's freshman year before you graduated. I covered his sophomore year. And then last year, of course, he just became a national sensation in the March Madness during his junior year. And now next year, it's just going to be Boeheim Palouse up there. But I've always found it so fascinating how, obviously, if you're Buddy Boeheim, if you're Jimmy Boeheim, you have like the world of basketball access. You get to meet Kobe Bryant and Team USA growing up. You get to, you know, be in the stands in New Orleans as Carmelo Anthony went. You're just around basketball your whole life. You have the money, you have the training. But does that drive you still have to reach to be able to make it to that level? Because I said this about Buddy, you know, we've seen a million coaches' sons walk onto their teams and just be, you know, walk-ons, not play at all. For Buddy to legitimately become the best player on the team last year by the time March Madness came around, it's just mind-blowing to me. So you, being a son of you know, notable player in your field as well, what's it take? How do you muster up that, you know, drive at that level to be that great, even though you had, you know, something to fall back on in your father's sense there?
Well, Bobby, I appreciate you having me and looking forward to some Celtics and Rondo talk and some maybe even mustache talk, because yours is absolutely outstanding. And I feel like I should have come to the table with more in my facial hair game. And that was a miss.
We'll talk about that.
For next time, I'll be ready to go. Maybe I'll have a full James Harden beard. Who knows? The world is everybody's oyster, right? So anything is possible. But for the Boeheim family, at least drawing on my personal experience to answer your question, you know, I think that when I decided I wanted to go into this business, I knew what was going to be attached. I knew that there would be murmurs or there would be thoughts from people that I was getting certain things just because of my name. And that might be true, by the way. I might have opportunities because of who my father is and how he has interacted and gone about his business over the course of his career. And so as a result, my mentality, at least going into school, was, well, I have to work twice as hard to prove that it's more than just that, and that I can do it myself, and that I can prove that I am worthy of any of these assignments. Now, whether or not that's true remains to be seen, but I do think that at least subconsciously, it did force me to put in that work to an even greater degree than maybe I would have before. And the other thing that it did for me was, growing up around it, I got to really see how the sausage was made behind the curtain. I got to really see what it took on a day-to-day basis to get to the eventual destination.
Did you have that 2003 Buddy Boeheim at the national championship moment? Like, what would that moment be for you?
There were a lot of them. I mean, there were countless moments like that growing up where I just got to tag along and be a part of something and see either whether it was the Nets or whether it was NFL stuff, just to see it firsthand and be there in the booth. And so, sure, I'm sure that there are some photos of me when I was younger at the U.S. Open or at Jets games or at Nets games or whatever it might be that were at least in the vicinity where I wasn't maybe traveling. And then some that I actually happened to be in a certain place and that's where he was going to be. And so we just made it work. But yeah, no, I think that when I look at Buddy and Jimmy, especially Buddy at first, let's just look at the whole situation. So Jim Boeheim says that, okay, I'm only going to offer them the scholarship spot if they're worthy of that scholarship spot. He felt Jimmy wasn't quite ready when he was out of high school. So Jimmy was good enough to play Division I at a pretty high level. He goes to Cornell, and he plays very well over the course of three seasons at Cornell. Plays very well. He's their leading scorer in his final year there. So he developed, and now, as we've seen with Buddy, Jim thought, Buddy's ready right now, and he's going to develop into a great player. He had the foresight to see it. He's obviously got, as you said, decades worth of experience. He knows what it takes, and he saw that Buddy had what it takes. And Buddy, to his credit, has put tireless work in. And I've talked to a lot of people within the program that just say that he works as hard as anybody across the country. And you can see it because you said it, Bobby, he's already taken some ridiculous strides forward in just a couple of years on campus. I can't imagine now to have that familiarity with your brother on the same team, your father coaching the team, to take another stride moving forward. It seems inevitable at this point based on his hard work. So just from my experience, I think being able to see what it took every single day and almost having that get into your brain like osmosis that helps. And then in the back of my mind, I'm always making sure that I put in maximum work leading up to any of these events. I'm doing whatever I possibly can to cover every single base, because I do know that people will still say, well, he's just there because of this, this, and this. So, you know, I would hope that over time, similar with Buddy, people just say, oh, wait a second. Okay, no, he's clearly done the work and he's earned his spot here. But that comes with time, and that comes with proving yourself.
For sure. Was that a good enough way? Was that different than the way you've been asked that in the past? I hope.
Sure.
Sure.
There's a variety of directions you could go. But yeah,
we do that differently here on Dome Theory. What I find most interesting about you and, you know, differentiating yourself from your father so far in your career is that forward vision you've had for the role, the broadcasting, you know, position in sports. And it's going to have to change into the future. It already is. And you've been part of it, finding different ways to do things and just connecting with a different audience, because, you know, sports viewers have gotten older. Sports consumption has gone down in the country, and the reasons for that have been thrown around all over the place for various different reasons. But I think part of it is that the audience has gotten older. Some of those people have moved on from that, gotten too old to keep following sports as a whole. And younger people, you know, by and large, all these studies are showing that, yeah, they're on their phone watching highlights. They're on YouTube more than they're watching games on TV. Certainly the radio at this point in the role that you're in right now. So, we'll talk about your Nickelodeon experience during the NFL playoffs. But in your day-to-day role as LA Clippers broadcaster, on the radio, hop in the car, turn that dial, find the game, either that or people are going to have to, you know, download an app and find your broadcast on there on the phone. How have you, you know, with a forward-looking vision in this job, tried to draw new audiences, you know, move kind of this role that's very traditional, you know, almost like 100 years old at this point, into the future and, you know, make it something that younger people can connect with out there in LA?
That is the dilemma. That is the biggest question mark of how to do it. And I think the biggest thing with any of these roles that I'm doing, you mentioned the Nickelodeon game or whether it even be with the Clippers, in a sense, you have a blank canvas and it's up to you to go out. Certainly that Nickelodeon game, because that had never been done before. We had a completely blank canvas. We could mold it and color it any way we wanted to make it seem like it was supposed to be. And so I think it goes to at least a certain extent for that Clipper job as well. In my opinion, I want to bridge the gap and I want to reach a wide ranging audience. So I want people who are 12 years old, just starting to get into the game, all the way through 72 years old, who have been following the game since the days of Wilt and Bill Russell or whoever. I want all of them to be enjoying and to be into it. And I want to find a connection with all of them. And I think a big reason that I enjoy TV, movies, music, books, I have to be extremely well-rounded so that I can find a connection with anybody in any age group. And so that's something that I try to incorporate on the broadcast, whether it be something I see on TikTok, so maybe then a teenager might like it, or it's something that I read or watched a movie from years back and I can drop a line from the movie Airplane and maybe somebody else will like it. Whatever it might be, if I can find just a wide ranging set of connections, I guess, to people, that's really what I want to do. Because at the end of the day, we always hear a lot of, if you went to Syracuse, you've probably heard this at least once, consider the listener, right? So how do I consider the listener? Well, I want to make them feel like we're just having a conversation and they're right there sitting next to me. And so the best way to do that is to make a connection with them. And the best way to make a connection with a wide-ranging group of people is to be just well-rounded in general. So I try to watch as much as possible. I try to consume as much as possible. I try to stay current with the news. I try to stay current with trends online. All of that goes into the preparation process, so to speak, on a more of a fun degree. But it still is part of it. It's part of the mold, part of what will make me into the broadcaster I hope to be. So it's just incorporating a wide variety of things into my game calls. And that's a skill that I've continued to try to sharpen now with each game.
Yeah. So we kicked around before we started recording here, the two guys in Boston who would
been doing it for years and years at this point. Mike Gorman on the TV side, Sean Grandy on the radio side. And there is a big difference between how you have to call these games on TV and radio, because there's just so much more ground to cover in the radio one. You're working hard trying to just let people know what's going on. There's not as much liberty as there is on the TV side to toss a lot of that other stuff in. But I do find it interesting, the contrast between Gorman and Grandy. Grandy, ultra prepared, you know, facts, all these allusions. He has like records and records of like the leading scorers in TD Garden history, just all these different files that he's always tossing out on Twitter, using Twitter as kind of like a second bonus to his broadcast. And then you have Gorman, who, you know, when you follow him and Tommy for all these years, Gorman was that way when he first came in. You know, he had the papers and all these facts and interviews lined up with people and just like this pile of papers on the table. And Tommy, when he saw it the first time that they were calling a game together, threw him off the table and said, "We're just talking about the game." And so that's how Gorman approached it from that time on. You know, he wasn't over prepared in a sense. He was just, you know, trying to have a conversation, a fun time, and just talk about what was going on in front of him with Tommy. And that was basically the persona that they took on for the rest of their careers. Right now in your career, what's your preparation process like? You know, what do you try to be as a broadcaster between those two, you know, extremes there, I guess you could call them? And, you know, do you see that evolving over time?
Well, Bobby, to your point, there's a reason that Mike and Tommy have been so beloved for so many years. It's because they make people feel, and we had been talking about this before we went live, but they make people feel like it, right? You're inviting them to be on this inside of watching the game with these two guys, as if you're all sitting on the couch and drinking beers. It's tougher to do that on the radio, because most of the time people are driving when they're listening to you, or they're stuck in traffic out here in LA, which is very common. So for me, it can be good that there's traffic all the time, right? Because that means that there are more people who are going to maybe turn it on because they want to see they want to hear what's going on. They want to hear how the Clippers are playing. For me, I would say, it's blending the two, because first of all, I do the games alone, and so that already contributes to then how I have to call it, right? I have to almost wear both hats at times, because I have to call the action, and then sometimes I have to explain why something happened on the floor to make sure that it's all taken care of under one umbrella. Whereas, you know, Sean has Max, so you've got somebody who's there, who's played a long time, who really has a good knowledge of the game, and he can provide that insight of what this play looked like or why they're doing this in this situation. So for me, I have to try to cover all of that. So that does factor in my preparation process, because I want to watch some film. I want to watch certain things to see, okay, what happens in this situation. I read a lot of articles about the opposing teams, especially, so I have a good feel for what their season has looked like, what they do in certain situations, what different players have been doing recently. So for me, it's a lot of stats. I get prepared with a lot of personal background on guys. So for example, last night, played the Minnesota Timberwolves. So I'm trying to think of a D'Angelo Russell, let's say. D'Angelo Russell started his career in LA with the Lakers. So it's an easy thing to drop in there. He had played a couple of years. He played his first two seasons with the Lakers, gets traded to Brooklyn, plays 2 years in Brooklyn, then he signs the max contract with the Warriors, then he gets traded midseason to Minnesota. And so now having all of that can kill any maybe dead ball time as someone who does the games alone. I'm going to need that to potentially fill some of that airtime. And so it's having that stuff in the back of my mind. I go deep into the analytics stats. I don't necessarily use very difficult analytics stats because I don't think most people understand them. And so if most people don't understand them, then it's not going to behoove me to say, well, they're third in the NBA in rebounding percentage, if I then have to spend 10 seconds explaining what rebounding percentage means, right? And rebounding percentage is one of the surface level ones. There are some deeper ones that I could use, like VORP, that nobody's going to care what VORP and who's leading the league in VORP.
That's when people are going to turn it off.
Correct. So it's balancing those two. It's balancing the stats and the right stats in the right moments with the human interest stories and humanizing the players with then all of those references that I had talked about earlier of connecting people. So it's all a balancing act over the course of a 48-minute game. And I'm still working to perfect all of it. And I don't think I ever will. I'm just going to be working towards that perfect game. I know Mike Tirico came back to campus when maybe you were probably a freshman, I think I was a sophomore, and he had said, I'm still looking for perfection. And I think every broadcaster is. Every broadcaster wants that perfect game, and they never, ever feel like they'll get it. But that's what keeps you working. That's what keeps you driven. And so that, for me, is exactly what I'm looking for.
Do you labor over the game long, or are you just right on to the next one? Are you looking back saying, I could have done this? I could have,
No, you can't let it keep you up at night. If I did that, I literally wouldn't sleep, and then that wouldn't be because my next game would be even worse. So, what I do is I come back home. The highlights get sent over to me. I listen back to the highlights. I listen back to maybe a stretch or two. Say, okay, here's where I could have improved, and then I try to work on that for the next game, and the same process continues. But my goal will always – has been since I got here. It'll always be, no matter what I'm doing, my next broadcast, I would like it to be better than my previous one. If I'm doing that, and every single time I'm on the air, I get slightly better, then I'll feel like I'm doing my job well.
So I'm going to toss a couple at you here. The feedback, whether it's a fan or whether it's Steve Ballmer coming to you and giving you some feedback on this so far, what's that been like since you started this job? And you talked about like that dynamic. You're mentioning Lakers stuff in these broadcasts, because this is forever going to be a Lakers city out there in LA. So you're almost appealing to that market as well. And that's interesting, because that's what your dad's done his whole career in New York, being kind of the junior team in New York City. You know, most people care about the Knicks. It's probably a little more balanced out there, and it's balanced out a bit since the Clippers have gotten better in LA, but it's still like, that's always going to be the B team in LA. And that kind of, I'm sure, has to come into how you cover the team there.
Yeah. I think there's a misconception from people that the Clippers are trying to steal Laker fans, and they're trying to overtake the Lakers and this and that. Just not the case. You know, Steve Ballmer is very savvy. For those who don't know, he's our team owner. Very savvy about how he goes about cultivating this fan base. He wants to captivate younger people so that they grow with the team. That's why he's moving to a new arena in the next couple of years. He wants to build his own space. He wants it to be futuristic, state-of-the-art, one of the best, if not the best, basketball viewing experiences in the entire world. And so he's working tirelessly every single day to make sure – he accomplishes that goal. And so he's not saying, hey, we know that you've been a Laker fan 20 years, but we think you should join the Clipper Nation. That's not what it is. And I think that's what people get upset with out here for some reason. There are people who are like, hey, it's never going to be a Clipper town. We're not saying it's going to be a Clipper town. We're just saying we've got our own little niche and we're trying to win a championship, and that's it. And so it can get contentious out here for sure, but I think that's the best part about it. It makes it so much fun. It really does. And you guys in Boston know about the Laker rivalry, what that's like. It's been established for sure out here. And when you talk to players, they certainly feel it. Talk to coaches, they certainly feel it. And I can tell you from the broadcasting perspective, being in Staples Center last year for Clipper Laker games before the COVID shutdown, it was nothing I'd ever felt before, including a full packed Carrier Dome, which is saying something.
Well, how about Harrell walking across the hall the way he did in free agency? That was like, what's going on here? That was like, some Mets Yankee stuff from back in the day. Like, you know, you're going to see a guy walking from one side of the town to the other. In this case, it's the same building. And those two teams were supposed to be on that collision course in the conference finals. They never got there. But that was one of the weirdest stories in all of free agency, was not only him leaving the Clippers, where he was, you know, a huge part of that team's come up, but going over to the Lakers after they won the championship. Like, that had to be part of the contentiousness there too.
I think that the Clippers had some plans, and clearly those plans ended up panning out. They signed Serge Ibaka, and that was really more of what they were looking for. You know, they felt enough of that size at that position. And so Montrez, while he is a great, great offensive threat, he's a great screen setter, he's a hustle player, he takes a lot of charges, he box guys out at an elite level in the NBA, he still is only about 6'7", 6'8". And so come playoff time, they struggled in terms of that size. They really did, especially against Nikola Jokic. And so what they have now, and once Serge is healthy again, and now that they've signed Boogie Cousins as well, they have 3 7-footers with Zubats, Ibaka, and Boogie, and that's huge for them. So, and he meant a whole lot to this organization, but they feel really good about right now. This is a team that feels pretty balanced, and the addition of Ibaka was a big factor in all of that as well. So It's been great to be a part of the Laker Clipper rivalry so far. In my time, it's been only these two teams being both great. Usually when one of them's really good, the other one's not. If you look at the last decade plus, obviously through the 2000s era, it was all Lakers, no Clippers. The 2010s, for the most part, it was all Clippers, no Lakers. After they won their second title in 2010, they didn't make the playoffs again after 2012 up until last year. And so if you look at that stretch, it was Lob City. That was all the success out here in La La. And so it's funny now that to see them both at the top, both of them being the Western Conference favorite, so to speak, that's been awesome to be a part of. And I'm really excited for when full fans, a full Staples Center can be back in business, because it's been an energy I've never felt before.
So let's do the Rondo thing. And this year's team in general, so interesting. Obviously, they should be ranked among the favorites to come out of the West, but that thing from last year just stains everybody's consciousness. What happened in that NBA bubble with them and the Nuggets there? A different team this year to some degree, same core. I do find it interesting, them and the Celtics, so similar. They played great games because you get those two star wings. You know, you get contributing forces there on the wing as well. Marcus Morris was an awesome Celtic. I still love him with the Clippers. Both teams need a little help at that point guard spot. Celtics went out and got Evan Fournier as a ball handler, and the Clippers got Rajon Rondo, which made a ton of sense. They needed a guy to set up the offense. They needed a guy who would win the playoffs, and that's a guy that they wanted in free agency, but ultimately just couldn't sign over the Hawks. So it was great to see him finally end up there, because it made a ton of sense. And they've gone on a tear since he arrived. He's gotten the ball moving more. He's a good defender, playoff experience, all that stuff. It's interesting, though, because – you know, you're kind of looking at this as from a distance. You know, you're not talking and interacting with the players the way you would be in a normal year. So it's probably tougher to feel like what kind of impact he's had on the room. But from what the distance that you're looking at it, what has Rondo brought to the team on the court and off the court?
Yeah, so I mean, we do get, or at least I get to talk to Teron Lu before every game. And so having that interaction and really picking his brain about what Rondo has already done to this organization, to this group, has been great to get some insight. And to me, that's been the biggest factor in all of it. And I know people have talked about it, but when Rondo was with the Celtics throughout that great stretch that he had, where he made four all-star teams, Teron Lu was an assistant coach for at least, I think, 4 years. And so to have those two, they're incredibly close, because Doc had assigned T. Lu as Rondo's guy. That was his assignment. He was the Rondo whisperer. That's what they called him. And they established this great friendship over those years, where it's almost as if they share a brain when it comes to basketball. They both watch hours and hours and hours of film. They both stay up way past the time that they probably should, just to make sure that they're watching other teams. They know exactly what they're going to get themselves into for the next game. And so it's been a perfect partnership to have those two, and then to have Chauncey Billups as well. You've got three guys who have played the point guard position at an elite level in the NBA. And what Rondo has brought already is raised the basketball IQ of the team. You mentioned it. He's got the ball moving at a very high clip. He's shooting the ball well still. And if you look over the last 5-6 years, he has shot it well from three over the course of those years. He's been league average or better the majority of those seasons.
Unbelievable. Him and Derrick Rose were the two guys you never thought.
No, and last year in the bubble during the championship run for the Lakers, he shot 40% from three. And it wasn't like he wasn't taking them. He was taking a couple of them per game. And so to have that boost off the bench now, and Patrick Beverley has been out of the lineup for the majority of the second half of the season. He's going to miss the next few weeks with a broken hand. So to have Rondo and have that calming presence down the stretch in games, it's made all the difference. And I think that's the biggest key, right? Let's look at those two Celtics games as a great example. The Clippers, the first game didn't have Paul George, which hurt them, although Boston didn't have Jaylen Brown. And Jason Tatum has crushed the Clippers, it seems like, every time they play. Jason Tatum, whenever anybody asks me, who are you most impressed with around the NBA? Last year, I got this question all the time. Now that you've seen every team, you've seen every player in person, who impressed you more than like you thought they would? Jason Tatum's the first answer every single time. He is out of this world impressive. I think I've said this a couple of times. I think he'll win the MVP by the time he's 27 years old. He's that good. And so he's crushed the Clippers. But to answer, to go back point, those two games, it was the lack of execution in the final 3 or so minutes from LA. and they had had those issues earlier this season. Well, for the most part, those issues have been somewhat fixed with Rondo there. You look at a close game against the Phoenix Suns, they pull it out in the end. You look at a close game at points in the fourth quarter against the Pacers on the road, they pull it out in the end. A close game against Detroit without their two stars and without Marcus Morris, without really all five starters essentially, well, they pull it out down the stretch. And Rondo's IQ, he's coached up his teammates. His calming presence has been a huge factor. So he's really made his mark early on this team. They've only lost once since he made his debut, and that was a three-point loss in they had chances down the stretch. So you feel good about where this team is right now. Everyone you talk to, including T. Lou, has just said, we feel really great about the position we're at this point of the season. And they've got, I think, 13 or so games remaining to just finish up, I guess, you know, fixing up whatever small issues they might have going into the postseason.
It's going to be a battle in the West. We got to talk about Tatum after you said that. The Celtics fans have gone through an interesting, and I'll go back to the first time I ever saw him out there in Syracuse when he was playing the Orange in that epic game where John Gillen hit the half-court shot, and everyone was going crazy about that, obviously, but I was looking at him saying, did you just see that guy on the other side? I mean, he had, if I remember right, it was 25 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists, and he wasn't running the offense, but he was, you know, making these plays out of the short roll, impacting the defensive side of the floor. He had that crazy Euro step in transition. And I said, this guy doesn't belong on this court. This guy could be in the NBA right now dominating. And then eventually the Celtics got into that lottery. I remembered that day and I'm like, you know, there were different doubts about his shooting and his defense and this and that. But I just remember seeing him that game and just instantly knowing like this guy is going to belong in that league at some level. Now, what he's accomplished, I never imagined. So early in his career, I think people forget. They say he's 19. That's like the joke in Celtics fan. He's been 19 forever, yeah. Really 23 at this point. But instantly into the league, impact defender, borderline all-defensive guy last year, which is what goes underrated about his game. And then the offense speaks for itself. Then in the bubble last year, at 22, becoming the playmaker that he did, 4 assists a game, running the offense for large stretches of that playoff run. He did have a few games here or there where the turnovers got a little high, and I felt like that cost him a few games. But again, you look at the total package here and say he's not going to hit his prime for a couple more years, and he's already one of the best players in the game, period. And so, you know, I hear you say that. In Celtics land, there's been a little overreaction this year because the team's been up and down. He's had his up and downs through COVID, and people are wondering, oh, is he really that great? Now he's come back in a big way this past month, 50, 40, 90, 44-point game, 50-point game, looking like that February 2020 version of himself. But what makes you say this guy is the most impressive player in the league to you?
So he's the biggest thing is he grew more, so he's even bigger than
oh
he
my
was
Lord.
And then he filled into his frame. So it's a combination, right? When we saw him at Duke, he was wiry. He was definitely thin, but you could see the makings of what would be a strong player. And so we were watching that game. They had Tatum. They had my boy Luke Kennard, who's with the Clippers right now. And they had Grayson Allen. That was a good Duke team. And they may have even had Harry Giles on that team as well. And so they had
Jefferson. That was Jefferson.
I think they had Giles too. I want to
say
they had
both off the bench. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that team should have went way further than it did looking back on it.
Agreed. And so they were good. You know, they were a good team. And Kennard was, I believe, their leading scorer that year. But Tatum, you're right. It's the fluidity in his game. It's just he can do a little bit of everything. His ball handling skill is outstanding. He can get his shot off over anybody. And I think that's the biggest key, right? It does not matter how close a defender is. It doesn't matter how draped the defender is. It doesn't matter what caliber that defender is. He gets his shot off. Doesn't matter. And you know exactly what he's going to do. A little step back to his right or left. You know exactly what's coming. Doesn't matter. You can't guard it. And he's just unfazed defensively. And so I think we've seen a toughness. We've seen a willingness to do whatever it takes to win. And I've heard from many people now that he works as hard as anybody around the league. And when you hear that and you hear his desire to continue to get better, to me, that just spells a recipe for a guy who's only going to get better and keep improving, which is scary because he's already, to me, one of the best wings in the NBA. And you give him a couple of years, I said, I think he'll be an MVP within the next 4 years.
For sure. Now, MVP this year, another story. A couple guys being mentioned. You know, you've tossed around the award discussions on your Sirius show. Jokic seems to be the consensus now. Others are holding out on Embiid despite the missed games. You're seeing other people included in this discussion. And I don't go as crazy about this as some other people do. Like, I've heard people on podcasts saying, like, we need a real assessment of what this award means. We can't figure it out. Like, you just kind of go with your guy and then, you know, let the results show. And they usually get it right. There's a few years looking back that maybe they got bored with Jordan or got bored with some other people who were winning it a ton, Kareem way back. But year in and year out, it feels like they get it close. You could say, oh, LeBron should win it every year, which some people do because of his stature in this league. But this is the most interesting race we've ever had, at least in our memories, probably. You know, you could throw Kawhi into that race. You could make the case for Steph Curry with the last month that he's just had. And the schedule, the injuries, and the COVID over the league have made it that much harder for voters this year to consider, you know, in Embiid's case. And he's actually my guy. Because I discount the, you know, probably 10, 12 games that he's missed there. I'm just going off what he's shown on the court, what he's meant to Philly, and how he's powered that team to the top of the East. That's kind of my depiction of it. And maybe that is the problem with this, is that you have a lot of different people looking at it with different ideas of what MVP is. But it's made it really contentious this year. I don't know if you heard Brian Windhorst and those ESPN guys screaming at each other on the podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. It's getting hot out there.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we have to keep in mind when it comes to MVP is it changes, the criteria changes year to year based on the circumstance of the season. And so if we were going by straight value, then yes, LeBron James is going to win every year because his value to his team, as we've seen over the course of time, is always going to be the greatest in the NBA. I mean, look, he goes to Cleveland first overall in 03 to make the playoffs within 2 years, and they were in the playoffs every year after that. He leaves, they're the worst team in the NBA. He goes to Miami, a team that was struggling to get over the hump. They win a title within 2 years. They go back-to-back. He goes back Cleveland after they did not make the playoffs once. You realize the last time that the Cavaliers made the playoffs without LeBron James, Mike Fratello was their coach in the 90s. That's how long it's been. And so for his value is greater than anybody in the NBA. So, yes, he would win it every year if it was just based on value. But that's not what it's based on. It's all based on best season overall, what you meant to your team during this season over the course of 82 or, in this case, 72 games. And this year in particular, you said it, durability is going to be a major factor. And that's why Nikola Jokic is number one on pretty much every list right now. He's played in every single game. He has not missed a single game for the Denver Nuggets. And by the way, if they can maintain that four spot in the West now without Jamal Murray the rest of the season, it's only going to help his case because he's going to have to put the team on his back even more right now after having several 40-point games, after having absurd triple-doubles all year, and the fact that he's been there every game. You said Embiid's missed, what, 12 to 13? He's missed 18 games this year. And there's only one MVP, I believe, that's played less than, I think it's 78% of a team's games. That's Bill Walton, who played, I think, 72 to 73%. I don't know. Those aren't exact stats, but it's somewhere in that ballpark. The other thing I'll tell you, the argument for the Currys and the Dame Lillards of the world. There's only one MVP in recent memory over the course of several decades now that has not been in, a top two or three seed in their conference to win it. And that's Russell Westbrook. When Oklahoma City was 5 or 6, and he averaged a triple-double for the first time since Oscar Robertson. So when you look at it, it took history for him to do that. There's nothing that's historical enough this season for anybody to overcome the lack of success at the top of their conference, to overcome not getting to a certain amount of games. So to me, if Jokic keeps on the pace that he's at, if he doesn't miss a single game, or maybe he misses one or two, whatever, it's all going to play into his factor and into his hand. So I think it's his to lose right now, but things change every single day in the NBA. Things change every single week. Like 3-4 weeks ago, I would have told you James Harden was right there in the running, and it looks like that's going to be out of the question as well. So it's just a year-to-year type of thing, and this sounds – it feels like, I should say, Jokic's year.
Yeah, and therefore, he's probably – he's probably got it. It feels like that's a consensus guy and the narrative is built. And again, that Murray point is going to be so important going forward and what he's going to mean to them post-Murray as they continue to try to win games here. I do think it's interesting, and this is what's taken over the sport too in recent years to some degree, is it's hard to, and this is why that screaming match kind of went on that podcast on ESPN, is that the number two guy there's a feeling that he's not going to get his due, whoever that runner-up is. Even third, fourth, and fifth places who have had outstanding seasons in the end, this happens every year. There's ultra-memorable seasons, whether it's Kobe with Nash or some of the other runner-ups there that have happened throughout the years, that it feels like are going to get forgotten just because there's an all-or-nothing approach. You know, we don't remember the runner-ups in the NBA Finals in this sport fondly. We don't even remember teams making it to the conference finals as a great thing. In Boston, the Celtics have made three or four, and the fans have turned it into a failure. So, like, this narrative around the sport, and I don't, you know, you're in the NFL world, baseball world, all these other sports as well. It feels like the NBA has this particular problem, and we'll talk about like the narrative of the sport and where it's going, that it's all or nothing. If you're Kevin Durant, you don't have a championship, you're a failure. If you're Kevin Durant, you're not the number one on your team, it doesn't count. Like, there's just all this, you know, narrative based goalposts moving in the sport on what qualifies as a success in your career in any given season.
Yeah, I think it's good and bad, though. I think that obviously the negatives, you pointed out a whole bunch of them. I think it can be taxing on players and their mental health. It can be taxing on a fan base and their mental health if their team continuously struggles to get over that plateau. But at the same time, it keeps the league constantly relevant because there are always these conversations. There are always these talking points. And this has been cultivated. This has been molded over the years from sports talk and from Twitter, social media, and the fact that people just like to debate. I think that's the biggest thing here. People like to debate. People like to disagree in general in life. You know, someone could say it's my favorite color on Twitter, and I think they'd get more hate than anybody known to man. They'd say, what about blue? What about purple? It's just how it works, right? And so the NBA falls into the same umbrella in the current scope of the world in general. People just like to go back and forth. It's part of the fun. And then at the end of the day, it's like, oh, you know, it's all in good fun. But it does keep the league constantly relevant. And it's made.
Do you really
NBA
need water?
Seriously.
That was one.
Yeah, does water actually make you wet? Like, it's just for the fun of it. But it has made the NBA 12-month-a-year league. And that is great. It's really good for the league. And so if it's going to create more intrigue and more interest from more sources, I'm all for it. I'm all down for whatever debate people want to have. I might not partake, but I'll sit on the sidelines and watch and listen.
All right, rapid fire. Your defensive player of the year.
Ben Simmons.
Most improved.
Julius Randle.
Those ones feel like givens for sure. Rookie of the year got interesting with LaMelo Ball going down. Where are you taking that one at this point?
Yeah, no, so I think it's going to take this last stretch of games here. It depends on if Sacramento can win enough and Halliburton continues to play well enough. I think he can
steal his game.
He's great, and he's a great, great player, and I think he could take it. Anthony Edwards would be the other. He's averaging over 18 points per game, so he could absolutely, just based on his stats alone. And you're right, the LaMelo thing was a bummer because he was playing out of his mind. So it's one of, those two.
Was the dunk of the year Anthony Edwards, or was it Miles Bridges? Man,
the Miles Bridges one was probably better just based on how far back he put that thing. Yeah, the Edwards dunk was an all-timer. But the Bridges one, someone said recently that it reminded them of when Vince Carter dunked over Alonzo Mourning. And that was one of my favorite dunks growing up, being a
on
Nets
Clint
guy.
Capella too. That makes a big difference.
Correct.
I think you what Otome in Toronto, you know, kind of a smaller wing. This was on a big center.
A shot blocker, a rim protector, one of the best shot blockers in the league. And so that to me was extra points.
All right. Nickelodeon, that game. So much fun. And I wanted to talk to you the next day. I was so excited, but you're a busy guy, so we'll talk about it now. How did that come together? And it was just such a smash success. I don't think I've seen anything in the sports world just get this much acclaim as that thing did. Because like you said, people always like to argue. You know, you can argue pretty much anything on both sides in the sports world. But everybody was coming out of that game, whether it was your call, the integration of TikTok talk and the slime and the references to, you know, Nick stuff growing up that we all grew up on. It just sucked people in and became a sensation. in a way that I thought was so different and so needed in the sports world now, because we'll talk about where broadcasting's going and where these sports are going. It needs a lot of new life. And so for that to come through and be a smashing success the way it was, and, you know, it's targeting kids, but even people like me could watch and look back to childhood and enjoy that, all while enjoying a sports game as well. It was just like the perfect storm of three different things coming together in there from my standpoint. I'll just let you fire away on how that came together and what that day was like and what preparation went into it and, you know, ultimately the reaction that followed.
You know, first of all, I appreciate all the kind words, and I'm glad that you enjoy the game, because we enjoyed doing the game just as much.
And it wasn't a great game either, which says all the more.
Exactly right. And so how it came together, pretty simple. You know, I think once Viacom and CBS all merged into one massive company, well, Viacom owns Nickelodeon as well. And so they had this idea that they built up and they pitched to the NFL to do this game, to cater it to kids or to a new audience of non-football fans, and to make it fun and to do a playoff game. And the NFL was all in. They were on board. They were excited about it. And so they had reached out, and by they, I mean CBS, had reached out to me while the bubble was still happening. So it was, I think, maybe during or just after our Clippers series with the Nuggets. And they called me and said, would you be interested in potentially doing this? And I said, yeah, it's literally created for my two favorite things, sports and entertainment. And I grew up loving Nickelodeon and a bunch of the shows on that channel. And so for me, I was like, yeah, 100%. I said, okay, well, you're going to have to talk to Nickelodeon. They'll see if they like you, and then we'll see if you're in. And so I got to talk to some people at Nickelodeon, just similar to how we are over Zoom. And I must have convinced them enough, because they liked me enough to give me the keys to the assignment. And so from that point on, we got ready. I mean, this was months ahead of time, right? This was back in maybe August, I guess. It was August. So back in August for a game that wasn't going to be until January. But they wanted to make sure everything was in place. So we were good to go from there. I did one practice game over the computer, which was nearly impossible to do with Nate and Gabby, who were both on the broadcast with us. And from there on, we got our assignment. We went. And the biggest thing that we all agreed on was, let's just have fun. And I mentioned it earlier, blank canvas. This is nothing that has ever been done before. But the idea was to cater it towards kids, cater it towards people that maybe have never watched an NFL game before. So as a result, we had to do a decent amount of teaching and blend it with, okay, we don't want to talk down to people. We also don't want to give too much info for the people who do know what they're looking at and what they're watching. And so we have to blend those. We had to blur those lines. And that was the biggest challenge, was to almost bridge the gap between the two. Because to your point, I think the biggest surprise for us were, we knew kids were going to like it. We had a good inclination that kids anywhere from 3 through 12 or whatever it would be, we're going to enjoy themselves watching the game. What we didn't think was going to happen was the degree in which 55, 65 year old people who tuned in liked it and wanted to stay and stick around and watch. And so that was cool. The fact that we got that wide ranging audience, and we really did connect with somebody from pretty much every age group in between, that means that we did what we were supposed to. And so we were thrilled to see the reaction that it got. And we hope that we get to do it again soon.
Was your phone just blowing up for days?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It was my phone definitely malfunctioned at one point.
Yeah, I remember my favorite, and there was so many great moments in it. Probably when you handed off to Gabby and let her run the play-by-play, because it was just like, you know, you were handing the baton and she was just trying out something that she wasn't 100% comfortable with, but it ended up just being a funny moment. And I think everybody involved kind of just put their pride to the side a little bit and had fun with this, and you know, just try to create these funny, almost like inside the NBA in a way, moments where you could just laugh at yourself and have a good time and joke around and just throw stuff all over the place and see what sticks out there. I know you did a ton of game planning from like the reference perspective. You went and looked at a bunch of old Nickelodeon references and had those piled up for all these different plays, and that played well sprinkling out throughout. I think you threw a good one out on a long sideline run, if I can remember right. But most of it just felt so natural and like just spur of the moment stuff. What, when you look back on it, worked best, and what was maybe your favorite moment of the night?
Ooh, it's tough to pick a favorite, and I did enjoy giving Gabby the play-by-play responsibilities. That was fun. That was unplanned. It was getting towards the end of the game, and as you mentioned, it wasn't necessarily a close game, and so I was thinking, all right, well, how can we keep having fun? And so I just asked the truck, are you guys cool if I do that? And they were like, yeah, absolutely. I like that. I like the fact that we highlighted how talented both Gabby and Lex Lumpkin, our sideline reporter, are, because they can do a variety of things. And so I asked them ahead of time, well, you give me some of the stuff you can do. What are some of the things that you do on Nickelodeon? So they told me impressions that they do. And so I tried to tee them up for those things like that. But yeah, I don't know if I could pick a favorite part. I really enjoyed the whole thing. I was a bit bummed that I didn't end up getting slimed, because that's every Nickelodeon kid's dream. Everybody who watched
that was that was Sean Payton, right?
Sean Payton. Yes. He ended up getting one of the buckets remaining and got him all over his J's, which I was like, whoa, bro. You gotta take those off. But apparently he's a Jordan brand ambassador. So now I realize I have something to aspire to in life, being someone who likes sneakers way too much for my own good. I need to become a Jordan brand ambassador at any and all costs, because that would literally just, it would be complete. My life would be complete at that point. I'd accomplish whatever I need to accomplish from Sean Payton's perspective. But yeah, so that was one of it. There was also a bunch of equipment nearby. So at the very last second, they said, oh, no, you can't do that. But no, the whole thing was just, it was a ton of fun, honestly. And we had a ton of fun with it. And like I said, hopefully we get to do it again. And we can now, with that experience, add more to it the next time. But it was all good. It was all an absolute blast. And I'm just glad that people responded the way they did.
No, it just makes me smile even looking back on it. And it's something that, no one's going to go back and watch Saints Bears highlights from the first round of the playoffs that year. But everyone's going to go back and look at those moments in the booth. And I think that's just going to make you smile, too. The fact that, you don't want to become the story, but if you can add to the story and supplement it in a way that brings people back to that game, or just brings people to the game in the first place, I think has to be an awesome thing for you. Now, looking forward off that, I don't know how many games are going to be done on Nick in the future, how many broadcasts are going to be done in non-traditional ways going forward, but I do think it connects well to the NBA. And I know you're on radio and there's not a ton of ability experience right now, but perhaps later in your career, being part of this new wave that I think the league desperately needs. I talked about, some of my gripes with the Celtics broadcast this year, and some of it's, people shifting around and them trying to figure out what's next after Mike and Tommy were institutions for 40 years. That's difficult. But I think that's a challenge the whole league's facing. I mean, broadcast booths have gotten really old across this league. The broadcasters and analysts of the game are getting older and older. There's a line where the league shifted at some point. And I think a lot of people look at the Shaqs and Barkleys of the world as looking at the game from like an outdated perspective. And that's kind of the majority voice. The fan base is much younger. The voices and analysts around the game are much older. That could just be as simple as getting more young guys in the booth like you. But I think there's more to it, too. I think, my biggest thing, and people have been saying this online forever, is that, you need voices that empower the sport. Don't talk down on it. Like, we've all heard the different older voices around the game that have said, this is nothing compared to when we used to play. This new game's soft. This game's terrible. Like, that just doesn't do the league well. And this is what's going on their broadcast night in and night out. So I think it drives people crazy that the product's so good. I wasn't alive in the 80s and 90s, but I've watched a lot of video, and it's just indisputable to me that there's more talent in the league than ever before. There's more compelling storylines, and just the competition, especially this year that we've seen, is incredible. So how do we find broadcasting future for this league that represents that? And what do you think your kind of part in it all is going to be?
Well, I would tell you that it's all cyclical, and this happens no matter what, no matter what sport you're talking about as well. If you go back to, so let's talk about the era of all those people that you mentioned, the Barkleys, the Jordans, the Ewings, the Olajuwons. That's the era of, it was physical. It was, you're not getting anything easy inside. Well, you can go back and listen to Wilt Chamberlain talk on any talk show. He used to go on those late night shows all the time. And he would say, none of those guys could play when we played, because we would really go after each other. It's just how it is. This is how it works. And no matter the facet, no matter the area of life, I feel like that's how it works when you're talking about anybody. I'm sure that there are singers who say, actually, speaking of DMX, rest in peace. There was a video that came out about him recently when he was on
Last one of the Drake, talk shows. Yeah.
And he was saying how he doesn't like any rappers now. He doesn't feel like they're part of the game. So I just think that's how it is in life in general. So I don't know if it's something that's a problem that really needs to be solved imminently in the NBA. I think that over time, as you said, more and more younger people start to take over more and more after years and years. And just because people can't do this forever. People can't live forever, unfortunately. I wish they could, because it would be awesome to be able to go back and talk to like Abraham Lincoln. That'd be cool, but we can't do that, right? So as a result, I just think that's all part of the cycle. And as the next cycle comes and more people have immersed themselves into the modern style of play and the modern game, you're going to get more of an appreciation for the modern game. And then in 10 to 20 years, more and more people will say, well, back in our day, we used to shoot from just 25 feet, not 45 feet. You know, it's just how it works. But then as over time, different aspects of the game will creep in and there will be different wrinkles and we'll have to appreciate those as well. So I think that's the best part about sports, is it's always evolving. You know, the NFL, I'm sure that there are NFL players that are saying, well, this guy, they wouldn't be able to throw for 500 yards on our old defense. Guess what? I'm sure they would, because over time, the whole point of the sport, right, is to get better and to improve and find ways. It'd be like if we were all still driving the buggy from the 60s. Well, no, we've got cars that are better and more improved and safer and drive faster and smoother, and the engine works better because over time we have found ways to work out the kinks and bugs. So I just think that's true in general, and that's always going to be the case. But yeah, to your point, as more time goes and more people who have grown up in this era are working and are prominent voices around the sport, then you're going to get more of that appreciation.
For sure. We'll take it back where we started. Jim Boeheim, I think they asked him at some point this year, has Buddy surpassed you as a Syracuse player so far? And he said, no, I'm still the better player historically in Syracuse history. When it comes to contrasting who you are as a broadcaster and who your dad is, Ian Eagle, as a broadcaster, I definitely see that you pulled a lot from him. You know, that's just a given, the inspiration that you pulled from your father. But how do you contrast yourself to try to be a different voice in this game for years to come?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because he's really good, and you want to be like him, or at least I do, because I watch his games or I listen to what he does if he's doing radio, and I'm saying, man, it's really good. He nailed every single part, every single aspect of the job. Whatever was required, whatever was asked, he did it and then some. And I think the biggest thing that he always passed down to me in terms of broadcasting was to be myself, and how imperative it is to be a successful broadcaster in any facet. You have to be 100% authentic. And so for me, what's a little different is, we talked about it, being younger, I've got more of a touch of, okay, TikTok or whatever's going on, social media, or some of the more, I wouldn't want to say less pressing storylines, but less pressing storylines around the world of things that maybe other people don't care as much about. So I just try to be myself, and myself is definitely similar to him in many ways, but different in others. We've got similar sense of humor, but sometimes a bit different. And so it's just being me and letting the rest take care of itself, and interacting when I am working with others, interacting with others at a very high level, and trying to establish legitimate relationships and friendships with those people off the air so that it's easy on the air. But a lot of that comes from him. And so it's blending those, it's blurring those lines again. And it's a process over time. I'm still trying to work it all out as I go on, but I'm only in year two, and hopefully it's a long several years ahead of time to continue to mold that personality and mold that voice over the years.
He is Noah Eagle. You can find him on Twitter at Noah Eagle 15, the radio voice of the LA Clippers. You can hear him on Sirius XM NBA channel as well. I'll leave you with some advice, since you wanted it so bad. Quarantine taught me, you know, we were all trying to grow our beards. I couldn't do it, believe it or not. So I just shaved everything else, experimented with the mustache, and it worked. So there you have it.
All right. So I'm going to, like,
just
I said,
keep experimenting. This,
it could be a hardened beard. It could be a Fu Manchu. You don't know what's coming. It's just going to be a surprise. But I'm going to have to come with a little action. I'll tell you that much.
For sure. Just keep trying new things out there in LA. I texted your dad this morning for some preview stuff, and he said the LA life is treating you well. How are you acclimating the LA life? I know you're representing with Death Row there. You're enjoying the sun, exercise, basketball outside. Like, what's LA Noah like?
It's pretty much the same. I always an LA type of person inside, and it just brought more of it out of me. So gluten free. No, I don't. I still eat gluten. I'm not not that far removed, but. No, yeah, it's good, man. It's, you know, I wake up every day and it's the opposite of what we experienced at Syracuse or on the Northeast, where every single day it's sunny, it's 75 or so degrees, and I just wear whatever I want. And that aspect has been great because, as I said, I'm a big sneaker guy. And I, when we're in Cuse, I could not wear all my sneakers because they would just get crushed in the snow. I was wearing Tim's every day. Out here, I can't wear Tim's. It's the opposite, but I can wear all my sneakers. And so I can experiment and I can mix and match a bit more, which plays right into my interests and my likes. So that aspect has been good. And yeah, the lifestyle, it's hard to beat.
When you're in Boston in seasons to come, I don't want you to get too used to that LA sun and weather and be complaining about the snow and cold, because you went through it in Syracuse and that should set you up for anywhere. Within 5-10 years, I don't want to hear any complaints when you go on these cold weather trips.
I'll be honest with you, I'm already complaining. So I'm gone.
Oh my God.
I've lost it all.
Minus on my 50 grip. Degree afternoon.
Ultra soft, real fast. Cool. It's all good. I've admitted it. I've come to terms with it, but I've gone soft and I'm okay with that. I can handle it still, but I'm okay.
55 degrees. No.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's pretty much me now. Where are my seat heaters?
All right. He is Noah Eagle here on Dome Theory. Great talking to you. Enjoy the rest of the season. We'll be following along your coverage throughout the playoffs, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.